This is Marge Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening today to my interview. Oh, now I'm going to have to ask this. Katie Wieland or Wieland?
Wieland.
Waha, there we go. Okay, so this is my interview with Katie Wieland, recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon on the lovely island of Vashon, Washington. So, Katie, thank you for calling in today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get to chat with you this afternoon.
Oh, and I am really excited because I have been totally watching you for a number of months now. And so this is going to be a great show.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I am looking here. Let's go ahead. What I like to do is give my listeners sort of a sense of what they can expect during this show. And so you have just very, very recently, like a number of days ago, I can count them on two hands, launched your diesel punk adventure novel titled Storming.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okie doke. And so we are definitely going to talk about what diesel punk is, because there's probably some head scratching mm-hmm. going on out there. And also, you are, to a certain degree, self-published.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so for those writers out there who are really curious about how self-publishing can be done well, we're going to talk about that. And then also, you actually have a great platform's the wrong word. You do a really good job of, is it mentoring or teaching, or how do you like to talk about what you do for writers?
I guess you could say that I would call it a mentoring. I don't do mentoring one-on-one, but I have my website, Helping Writers Become Authors,
mm-hmm.
where I try to interact a lot with writers. Basically, it was a site that started out as something where I was really just sharing my journey as a writer and what
mm-hmm.
I was learning. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own, where I'm also, you know, focused more on trying to help other people and, you know, also obviously still sharing what I'm doing, what I'm learning.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just through the website. You have a plethora of books.
Yes. It kind of morphed into its life of its own when I started doing books that were pretty much based off of the site. I did one on outlining your novel,
mm-hmm.
and then another on structuring your novel.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have workbooks. And then I did one last year that actually is my only traditionally published book, which was the Jane Eyre Writer's Digest Annotated Classic, which was a really fun project to work on and something that I really learned a lot from. So
mm-hmm.
that was a lot of fun.
Definitely going to touch in on some of that because, so like, there's a wide range of awesome things that we're going to talk about today. So let's go ahead and start off actually with Storming. You've got to know exactly how many days ago did you launch this?
11 days. It was on the 4th.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. That means I have too many fingers on my hands.
Almost not too many.
All right. I'm putting a foot in there. I can count on my hand. Okay. So what I really like about how you pre-launched Storming, and I haven't actually seen this done quite in this way before, which is why it really caught my attention, is, I mean, you know, for me especially, a lot of books fly past my face. Boom, 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 boom. And so sometimes tracking the title of a book can, you know, like, I'm like, oh, wait, that book by so-and-so about blankety blank, but I don't remember all the titles. I totally had Storming stuck in my head a couple of months ago because you have these really great email newsletters. Is that what they're called technically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, e-letters,
right.
I guess.
E-letters, okay. You're the only person I subscribe to, like, in the world. I love that you always are giving me basically a really great snippet about a specific way in which I can improve my writing, which is brilliant. But you did that thing where you would say, you know, blankety blank, what I learned while writing Storming.
Mm-hmm.
And how many months did you run that concept on the titling of your e-letters?
That was pretty much for just the month before the launch. I've heard somewhere, I think it's like it takes 7 times for someone, they have to see something for it to really sink into their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I try to be aware of in my marketing, is just putting it out there in a way that's unobtrusive and non-obnoxious, hopefully. So people are seeing the cover,
yep.
seeing the title,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, so that it kind of sinks into their awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I try to do, because the Helping Writers site has really become more about helping other writers than it is about me, I still obviously want to use that platform as a way to tell people about my fiction,
mm-hmm.
but I also feel like I have to be really careful to do it in a way that isn't all me all the
yeah.
time, because that's not why people are coming to that
right.
site. So I did this with my last launch for my Fantasy Dreamlander as well, and trying to think of, well, how can I bring my fiction in front of them in a way that they would actually appreciate?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the site is about teaching other people how to write. So I've tried to kind of mine my experiences with my novels and figure out, well, what specifically have I learned from the process of this particular book that I can share with people?
Mm-hmm.
And then that allows me to organically kind of bring a discussion of the fiction in. It's a lot of fun, really, for me, too, because it kind of, like I said, it goes back to the roots of why I originally started that website, which was to share my journey as a writer.
Right. So, well, you said organically, and I was myself thinking, you know, it makes it very natural flow for you to be. And it's not like, okay, I'm going to come up with a calendar of things that writers need to learn about, and then I'll write. You know, it's not like this dry thing. You're like, I imagine you're in the middle of doing something, and suddenly you're like, oh, that's how I can fix that problem. And then you're like, I need to tell people about that, right? So I think you just nailed this perfect intersection between these two things that you're trying to do, because you're absolutely right. I never felt sold to.
Oh, well, good. I appreciate that. And that's really good feedback to hear, and because that's definitely what we were going for.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, folks. So, and then he died. No, I'm kidding.
Spoiler
alert. Late. No, I'm totally joking. By the way, that's a total joke, everybody. It does not say that on page 447. So this is a hefty book. You must have a huge story in here.
Yeah. It was actually, I generally shoot for about 100,000 words, which is pretty average, I'd say. It's on the small end of average, really. I think,
it is.
For normal books. And that one, I think, topped out at about 140,000.
Okay, I was going to go, this is not 100,000. Oh, you have some artwork in here, too.
Yeah, it's the first book, actually, that we featured illustrations in, which was really exciting. They were done by an artist named Jana Marie, who's actually, she's been with me since my second novel. She did the map in that, and she did some maps with the last one, but she, like, totally outdid herself, I think, in this one. I was really happy with how they turned out.
Well, I will admit right now that while I've been aware of this book and I have a sense of some of what it's about, unfortunately, my promotional copy arrived in the mail yesterday.
Oh, my gosh. That was late.
I know. I actually almost went and bought it as, like, an ebook, you know, a few days ago. Last week, I would have if my friend had not landed in the hospital and I had not been completely swamped. But yeah, so this means this is my Christmas present to myself. I'm actually going to probably wrap it, throw it under the tree, and then I'll like lay around and, well, I usually drink champagne like 3 times a year, and Christmas Day is one of those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll make some mimosas and I'll read Storming.
Sounds like a plan.
So why don't you tell us then a little bit about Dieselpunk?
Yeah, so steampunk is something that more people are going to be familiar with. And basically the concept of steampunk is that you're having kind of more modern technology that's steam-powered and usually set in, like, the Victorian era. But
so let me make sure I understand that. So instead of being historical fiction where you would go back to the Victorian era and you would use what was actually existing at that time, this is where someone went back and almost added like a futuristic aspect of better, greater, awesomer stuff you could do with steam engines, but it's set back in that time.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Oh, okay, all right.
And then you've got, really it's becoming very popular, and you've got a lot of spin-offs in different directions, and one of them is Dieselpunk. Basically, it's kind of the same concept, kind of the same stylistic feel to it, but it's set during or in between the world wars,
mm-hmm.
where you have diesel engines. So you've got, mm-hmm. like, obviously in my story, features around biplanes and dirigibles, airships, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of, I don't want to call it alternative history because it's not, you know, in any way strictly historical,
mm-hmm.
but it's something in a historical period that has a lot of imaginative and almost fantastical elements to it. Right. So, I write both historical, straight historical, and fantasy novels. So this one was kind of really a fun departure, since it let me kind of do a little bit of both, because it's firmly grounded in a historical period. It really,
well, and a real location, Nebraska.
Yeah, actually, it was the first book that I've ever set in a place that I've actually lived, which is mm-hmm. my hometown where I live now, in western Nebraska, Scotts Bluff, mm-hmm. Nebraska, which was a lot of fun to be able to write about places that I, you know, have known about and lived in for so long.
Okay. So what I'm sort of thinking, like, there's urban fiction is when you write in the real world is a concept. And so, like, my novel is urban fiction with a supernatural bent.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems almost like this is, because I'm thinking diesel punk, in a way, I almost feel like you're doing what traditional sci-fi people have done, where they imagine technological things that don't actually exist. And you have to get into all the nitty gritty if you really want to pull it off. Well, you have to make it sound like it really could be plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And the advanced diesel technology in your story is not going to be anything that actually exists at all in the real world, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's that really strong creative thing that we expect in sci-fi.
Yeah, I would say so. In mine, you know, it's one of those stories actually that's been tough to market, just because it's hard to nail down.
Huh.
And it definitely is the whole diesel punk angle. But I've also, in the beginning, I'm like, do I want to market it as this? Because it's very, very firmly grounded in the historical period and just kind of the real world. But there's these fantastical elements that mm-hmm. are shot through it.
Let me see, a young woman in an old-fashioned ball gown falls from the clouds right in front of his biplane.
Yeah, well, it starts out, you know, like I say, it's grounded in the main character, the pilot's real world, but there's, you know, right from the beginning, the first page, you have this woman who's falling out of the sky and doing these impossible things, and mm-hmm. so you have this mystery
yeah.
that's leading up to the diesel punk elements that become clearer and clearer as the story
yeah.
progresses.
I am totally excited. I mean, I haven't sat down and allowed myself in a while. I've been really busy the last few months, and I haven't really been able to sit down and just, like, give myself 3 days, you know, and I'm so glad it's a big book.
Yeah.
Now, I was looking at the front cover here, and I could be completely wrong, but the way the art was done, what I find interesting is that the hand of the male character holding the binoculars at the bottom, it almost looks like an old-fashioned photo, but then you go up to his face and you can tell that it's definitely, you know, artistically created. And I'm wondering, did you by any chance actually take a real photo and then blend it with art?
In all honesty, I have no idea, because I didn't do the art. It was my covers are done by a really fabulous design company called Demanza.
Oh.
And they've sent me, like, I get like the root file that they use, so that if I need to, like, edit the text on the back or something, I can do that at the last minute. But I looked at what they did on it, and I'm like, I don't even have a clue. I mean, I've done some design to some extent myself.
Right.
But what they're doing is just incredible to me. I just can't even get my mind really around how it all works. But
so do you see, though? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, now that I've said this, you know, seriously, I'm looking at that. It would make sense, actually. It would be so really spectacular if you could actually pull out, like, this picture of a person who, you know, was a post-World War I, mm-hmm. you know, pilot, and say that's the real person this cover mm-hmm. is based upon. I mean, talk about awesome.
I would bet it's really got to be stock photos, but I agree, that would be very cool.
You're going to have to call them up and ask.
Yeah.
Okay, so great. So then, do you want to tell them a little bit about the storyline?
Well, as much as we can without spoilers.
That's right. No spoilers. No spoilers.
So basically, the story begins when we have a woman in an old-fashioned ball gown who falls out of the sky right in front of our hero's biplane. And he, after kind of reconnecting with her once they are both on the ground, learns that she's claims that she comes from the sky. And he has to, that there's danger coming, that she has to get back and solve. And of course, he thinks she's nuts and doesn't believe her, so there's a lot of fun interaction that was really fun to write there.
Mm-hmm.
And then as things progress, he learns that he is going to have to help her prevent storm-wielding sky pirates from basically wreaking havoc on western Nebraska, which he's just returned to after a long absence, but was the hometown that he left.
So real quick, let me jump in there, because I know very, very little about Nebraska, but I know a little bit about it. And I know a little bit about the expansion of agriculture post-World War II. So I'm curious, before World War II, what was going on with cornfields in Nebraska?
Corn and beets are actually the big crops here.
They were already being grown before the Green Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Actually, in the very first chapter, it talks about how he's come back after about 9 years. And there's a lake there that he doesn't remember. It wasn't there when he left. Because it was actually, it's Lake Minotaur. It's the big lake here in western Nebraska. And it's actually totally man-made. It's an irrigation runoff lake. Because nothing grows in Nebraska without water. We're in a drought half the time, which is also a big part of the
frozen.
Story. Yeah, exactly. There's 12 inches of snow on the ground right now.
Right.
Yeah, so it's farm country, but it's very much because we've made it that way with the irrigation, et cetera.
And so he comes back, and that has all happened. Now, I'm curious then, would that have been one of those work projects that was used to help us get out of the Great Depression?
Well, since this is set in 1920, I'm pretty sure it's not.
Okay, got it. I wasn't sure exactly which year. Okay.
Yeah, 1920.
Got it. All right, okay, so go on. Sorry, Dovin. I just was imagining sky pirates that are going to use their storms to knock down your corn. That's actually where that all came from.
Yeah, which is actually kind of where I was going with that, because that's a big thing here. It hails in the summer. And
right.
I mean, even though I'm not personally a farmer, I live surrounded by cornfields, and that's always the first thing I think. Oh, the corn's been horribly damaged probably.
Right.
So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing to me to live in an area that is all about agriculture. Mm-hmm. And yet we also have all this horrible weather that is really detrimental to the crops. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of something going on in the back of my mind in picking the location for the story. Originally, when I first conceived it, I was thinking Kansas. I don't know why. I mean, I drive through Kansas. That's all I do in Kansas. And then I was like, why don't I set it here? Why not here? Because I've never done that before. And it was just really fun to have such a vivid knowledge and image of what I was actually writing about for a change.
People think writers just sit around and write. Well, there's also all the research side of what you're doing. So do you know Nebraska better now than you did before?
I do, actually. You know, it's kind of crazy. There's kind of a joke that we have in my family. There was a friend who came from Vermont along a couple years ago, I don't know, a while back. And he knew more about our area than we did because he had actually, researched it before coming because he wanted to see what sites there were. And so I kept thinking of that as I was researching because I kept learning all these things that, I've lived here for 20-plus years and things that I had never known about before. And it was just really interesting and made me appreciate kind of just the history in the area a little bit more.
Yeah. I've interviewed a couple of people who have written books that are based on Vashon Island, and one of them is a historical exploration, and it's like, really? There was a, like a factory that made bombs, type of thing, or it was TNT. It was something like that, and then it blew up. And then the other woman had written about gardening and a little bit of a historical, so you're like, oh, really? There used to be a blankety-blank on that lot that now has, So, yeah, there are adventures right around the corner and next door if you just know how to find them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I absolutely had more fun writing this book than I have anything else I've written up to this point. And I think a large part of that was that the setting was just something that it was close to my heart.
Right.
It was something I was familiar with.
So Storming is based in Nebraska, the real Nebraska in the middle of World War I and World War II time period, but it's got that awesome diesel punk adventure, added stuff to it. And real quick, I'd like to remind our audience that Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, just across the water from Seattle on Vashon Island, Washington. And I'm talking today with Kate Weiland, correct?
Katie Weiland, yeah.
Katie Weiland. Sorry. I wasn't sure if Katie was like a casual and you went by Kate. Okay, got it. Katie? Because it only says KM. So let's talk about how to find this book real quick. You write as K.M. Weiland, which is spelled Weiland. And so let's move over a little bit to the conversation of self-publishing, because, and there's going to be tapping in the background because I'm on the computer here looking up your website as we speak. I would like to also, real quick, you mentioned this design company that you're really happy with. Mm-hmm. What's the title or the name of the company?
Damonza, D-A-M-O-N-Z-A. And actually, if you do get to my site on the
there it is,
right-hand column, you can see it too.
Oh, that's even better. Okay, yeah. So, all right, so I'll spell it for everybody, but then I'm going to go straight to your site, which I've got up here. So, wow, look at that. Okay, so when you go to Katie's website, on the right-hand side, there's going to be an icon for Damonza.com, or if it was being pronounced in Spanish, it'd be Damonza. And when you click there, which is where I went initially, you do see, oh, structuring your novel. Ha, there it is. So you see all these beautiful covers, and that specifically says books made awesome. Honestly, back to those writers out there that are trying to figure out whether to self-publish or look for an agent and do the traditional publishing route. What am I going to do? Ah, one of the things that is really a challenge when you're self-publishing is that you do it all yourself, or you hire people to do it for you. And I've seen some really horrible covers out there.
Yeah. So far. In fact, some of them were probably mine in the very beginning.
Tell us a little bit. I mean, you are way out there. You are one of those successful self-publishers. So what tidbits would you offer up to someone if they wanted to pursue self-publishing, but they wanted to pursue it with a strong commitment to actual true success rather than, well, this is an easy thing, I'll just get my mm-hmm. book out and go back to my real life. The person who actually wants to build a career and be a successful self-publishing person, like, what are the top three things they really need to nail down?
Well, first thing, definitely, which is also the hardest thing, and also the hardest thing I think to be objective about, is you have to write something great. Because you can have all the other pieces in place, the marketing, the book cover, and if the content doesn't hold up, you will hear about it, and it will not work out in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
So first, you know, and I think, you know, that's the biggest step, and it's also the one that requires the most work and the most time up front. And I think, you know, as we've heard over and over again throughout the discussion of self-publishing and if it's really a valid way for authors to go, not so much now, but particularly when it was first becoming a thing, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that was a really big concern. And I think it still is. And that's always my big concern whenever I hear that someone is wanting to self-publish. Obviously, I'm a big fan mm-hmm. of independent publishing. It's treated me very well, but it's still something that I'm always cautious about recommending
mm-hmm.
because I really feel that the author has to start out with that really great product and has to be able to be objective enough about their own work and the feedback they're getting to be pretty confident that what they're doing is going to be something that readers are going to accept on the same par as they would something that's published by, you know, a major publisher.
Right. Yeah. You know, I had a friend recently. Okay. So the same friend, the first year I started writing The Ghost Lords, I was injured. And I'm like, I'm a very physical, active person. Suddenly I'm sitting around twiddling my thumbs. And so all these thoughts and ideas that I had, I'm like, well, I'm sitting on my butt in front of a computer and unable to do much. So bam, I'm going to go ahead and put these write the story. So the first year I was pretty consumed. And I had a friend who got sort of frustrated, and she's like, okay, well, you know, we don't get together as much, because we did. We really like each other. Great friend of mine. And she's like, I'm not seeing you very much, and I really want to get together. So when are you going to be done with that book? You know, and I knew enough to be like, well, this is sort of the beginning of a long, long period of time.
Never.
You know, I'm like, yeah, exactly, right? But then about 3 years later, she comes up to me and she says, okay. And she says, you know, I have a friend just self-published a book and sent me a copy. And as I was trying to read it, all I could think of was, I don't want March to self-publish.
Mm-hmm.
Because she said, it was like it was misery trying to force herself to read this mm-hmm. book, which she felt she needed to because, you know, and I said to her, I said, you know what? I said, regardless of whether I self-publish or not, I said, I would never self-publish because I couldn't do it the other way. Because for me, the way I look at it is if the big publishing houses and if agents and if those people are saying, you're not ready yet, go back and work more, I'm not interested in what you have yet, get it better, then some people at that moment, they say, oh, those people, they're just, you know, keeping the gate closed. They don't care. You know, my work is wonderful. They just don't realize it. And that person then goes and self-publishes, and it's premature.
Yes.
And then you get your book out, and it's really revision number 14, and you needed to get to revision number 25 before you were going to actually have culminated your piece. And now you've put it out there early. And I just think a lot of people jump the gun.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, like I say, it's a hard thing to be objective about, because on the one hand, it is getting harder and harder and harder to be published mm-hmm. by a traditional house, because they, you know, are continually raising the standard and banking only on what they're pretty sure they can make money on.
Mm-hmm.
So they're rejecting a lot of people who are great.
Mm-hmm.
And those people have, you know, every right to self-publish and probably will do really well, probably better than they would with the traditional house.
That's becoming
but
true.
You have to be able to be objective enough about yourself and get enough objective feedback from readers, and I always recommend hiring a professional editor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're getting, you know, across the board, everybody loves the story,
mm-hmm.
then you're probably right in thinking, yeah, I should go ahead and self-publish. But if you're getting negative feedback, it's only going to get worse when people start having to pay money to read it.
Yep. And they're not your brother or your dad or your best friend or the neighbor in your small town who doesn't really want to have to face you in the coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
you know, every day when they, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that would be my number one tip, is make sure that you're ready mm-hmm. to publish. And after that, the single biggest key, I think, to success, which isn't a surprise, but is definitely building a platform so that you're able to market. Because otherwise, mm-hmm. I don't know, have you ever heard of how people would describe Twitter in the early days as this giant chat room where everybody's talking at once?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of the internet. That's how
right.
marketing is in general. Because the truth is, nobody cares about us. They do not care that we wrote a book. They don't care that it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And it always comes back to finding a way to get them to pay attention. And
mm-hmm.
I think the key to that is what's in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And just saying, oh, well, I have an awesome book, that's what's in it for you,
mm-hmm.
isn't enough, because they're not going to believe you.
Right.
So, and that, like...
And are you even going to, you know, because like Twitter's only 100 and some odd characters, you mm-hmm. know, so even if you get them to come to your website, like first you have to get them to take the step to actually come and look, you know, and maybe then they might start reading about your story and think, oh, maybe I'm going to like this.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people aren't even going to take that step. So, yeah, there's a bunch that goes into it.
And I think that, you know, if you can build that platform, that audience that care not just about your books but about you and whatever it is that you're giving them on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
then you really, you know, after time, and it does take a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
it's not something you can do in even a year, I would say.
Oh, I would say definitely not.
Yeah, after time builds
yeah.
up, there's this basis of loyalty, I would say, really,
mm-hmm.
where you've proven yourself to them as a writer, and they're maybe even interested in you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, at some point, just kind of snowballs and
mm-hmm.
becomes something that you can really use in a way to actually market and get people interested in buying the book. So tip number three would probably be back to the covers. Because I think that if you've got the other two pieces in place, that a really bad cover can still totally
mm-hmm.
ruin the deal for you. Because, I mean, we know it's true. People judge books by their cover. I do all the time. I've bought books with gorgeous covers that were absolutely horrible. So I'm trying to break myself of that habit. But we still do it.
Right.
So if you can get a really awesome cover to go with your really awesome book, then you're twice as likely to do really well with it, I would say.
Well, and awesome on the cover, right? You know, so awesome would mean it actually relates to what the story's
mm-hmm.
about.
Yeah.
You know, or it's eye-catching, or it's thematic, or it's going to stand out compared to other things. I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, awesome doesn't mean pretty.
Right.
Awesome doesn't, you know, awesome means it will function successfully as opening the door to that person wanting to buy your book and enjoy the wonderful story that you have to offer them.
Right, the right person. I mean, you don't, if you put a romance cover on a horror book, you're totally drawing the wrong audience in.
Right.
And that's why, that's the reason why I always would recommend as well, you know, if your budget at all allows it, you know, right under the editor, put it on the top of your list to hire a professional book designer, book cover designer. Because there's totally an art to this. And this is something that I've studied for pretty much as long as I've been publishing, and I still wouldn't trust myself to really know how to put together a good cover. So it's definitely worth the money to get someone who actually knows what they're doing. There's actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Joel Friedlander, who runs the bookdesigner.com.
No.
He does, every month he does a best book cover award where people can submit their books. And then he kind of does a critique.
So you're going to hear typing in the background because I want to look this. So, so Joel, J-O-E-L, and then Friedland?
Yeah, Friedlander.
Fried?
I think that's
there,
right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, there he goes. It's that, what, German, I-E-D. It's like Friedlander. Okay, the book designer. There you go. And you're saying, where is it going to be on here?
I might have to look myself. But it's like the first of every month or something.
Got it.
Like he lets people submit, and that's something I always submit, just because I feel like it's a really good way to gain visibility for the cover, even if it doesn't, you know, actually win anything.
Sure.
But I've learned a ton, you know, myself, in just understanding what goes into a really great, he focuses particularly on ebook covers.
Oh, this is a great, okay, all right, everyone out there, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is brought to you in two ways. If you live on Vashon Island or in the surrounding areas, you can pick us up on 101.9 FM, and that's KVSH. But if you are anywhere else in the world, and I have a lot of authors like Katie who are from all over the planet, and you want to come back and listen later because we've said something or someone's name and you miss it or something, you can listen to the show on demand. You go to www.voiceofvashon, that's V-A-S-H-O-N .org. So I'm going to say to all of you who are writers, just looking at this website, I totally get why Katie mentioned it. So it's thebookdesigner.com.
He offers some really, really great resources beyond that. He does book templates that make it really easy for authors to like use, just add a word. You don't need any special software. And you can use those templates to produce really professional, both paperbacks and ebooks. And I haven't used them myself, but they just look like an amazing idea. And
yeah, it's down here on the, as you scroll down the right, there's book templates, and then there's a book launch toolkit, quick and easy media kit for authors, yada, yada. Yeah, this guy looks like a nice source. I'm putting him in my bookmark.
He's really definitely worth following.
Yay, he's now in my bookmark. There you go, favorites bar. Okay, I've got a couple of writer friends that I'm going to toss this their way. So so self-publishing, how long have, when did you start?
I was trying to remember that this morning. I think it was 2006 when I did my first novel, which in all honesty, I would probably, if I was me now recommending me then, I would have said, wait, honey. But it was 2006 when the ball all kind of got rolling, and that was back before.
Wait, which one is that?
That's A Man Called Outlaw.
Yeah, yeah, there it is. Got it.
And but that was back before the whole ebook revolution. So I did the whole print a humongous print run of paperbacks for a gazillion dollars.
Really?
And I still have them down in my barn.
Oh, so, okay.
It was just, you know, one of those things. And then after that, you know, like within just a couple of years after that, the Kindle came out and the whole thing, you know, the whole POD thing, print on demand, and the whole industry was revolutionized. So it was really good timing for me.
So let's make sure people sort of understand that. So traditional publishers, well, okay, so before the internet really got going, a lot of people, if they're going to self-publish, would go, literally, you know, you'd see them, they'd like be at the big conference you'd go to or a big convention somewhere, and there's this table with a person and they got boxes of books in there. So it was print a bunch, go out in the world and try to sell them on the road or whatever. But now with print on demand, that literally means what?
It literally means that it's printed as it's demanded. So whenever someone orders a book, like say off Amazon, mm-hmm. I publish through CreateSpace, which is actually an Amazon subsidy, so they're all kind of connected.
Right.
Somebody orders a book off Amazon, that book is not printed until that moment. It's printed by CreateSpace and then sent to the reader. So there's not this huge backlog
right.
of books that nobody wants. They're printed
right.
as people want them.
Right. Okay. And then, of course, we have e-books, and everyone sort of understands that you know, it's a virtual mm-hmm. book on your Kindle or whatever. And there's Nooks, Kindles and Nooks, right?
There's actually, I don't know, probably half a dozen at least more e-readers, but those are the main ones.
And there's e-readers you can get for your computer, too. So if someone
yeah.
says, I don't want to spend a couple $100 on a Nook or a Kindle, you can, for free usually, download mm-hmm. an e-reading piece of software from the internet onto your computer, and
yeah.
then you can go ahead and read there. So to put this into context, this is a loose idea. It's pretty darn accurate, but it's sort of loose. The big publishing houses, the method they had when they got their books out to Barnes & Nobles or out to the other stores that don't even exist anymore, is they would produce mass quantities of these physical books. They would ship out mass quantities to these bookstores, and you'd walk in the front door, and there's a giant table with, you know, 300 books of the same author, mm-hmm. and they're all piled up, and you're thinking, wow, that author's really successful. That book is really desirable. A lot of people want it. They've ordered all these books. They're going to sell all these books. But the reality is that the bookstore that ordered all those books was not required to keep the unsold copies. Mm-hmm. And after a period of time, they would send back all of the books that they didn't sell and basically get their money back, or however that would work.
Mm-hmm.
And when the big publishing houses received all these unsold books, I believe they literally destroyed them, right?
Yeah, that's what
right.
happened, which of course is why publishing houses can't afford to bank on authors that aren't going to sell, because
right.
otherwise they end up with all this money out on books that are useless.
And they still, what's the percentage of if you're a success, something like if you're a really successful author and you're the one that they bank on and they win the lottery and you do great, Stephanie Meyer,
mm-hmm.
You know, Suzanne Collins. I mean, even these books that are doing really, really good, Hunger Games, Twilight, all that stuff, don't they still have some insane percentage of books that end up getting destroyed?
That I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's some.
Maybe not
turnover.
With the really successful authors.
Yeah. I mean, but definitely with the ones that aren't to that extent.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like 20, 40. I mean, like big percentages. And this was pre-housing bubble, you know, pre-collapse. It was back when
mm-hmm.
waste could still function well as part of your business plan.
Yeah.
And now things seem to be a little bit leaner, a little bit more less wasteful and more careful.
Which is also great, you know, because I just hate the thought of, you know, whatever, 50,000 or more books just getting destroyed. And that's the great thing, too, about e-readers is, you know, they're treeless.
Yeah.
So I love, you know, I can carry my little e-reader around in my purse or my pocket, and it's got, you know, more books that are on my shelf, and
mm-hmm.
it's lightweight and no paper. And
right.
I just love it. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, okie doke. So storming, and we've talked about, let's see, what else did we want to talk about today? You write historical novels. You've done diesel punk. You have done helping people, structuring your novel, outlining your novel. When you're choosing what to write about, and we were talking about this the other day, I mean, it's story first, but really a character isn't interesting, I think, unless they face a conflict or a challenge that readers can relate to and somehow overcome it.
Mm-hmm. That's something I've actually been thinking about a lot lately, is how much I'm drawn to broken people, broken characters. And I think it's because of that very thing, is there's a lot to relate to, I think,
mm-hmm.
because we're all, you know, struggling with something.
Right.
But there's also so much meat there, I guess you could say, of just interesting thematic explorations of where we can go with helping this person overcome it, or just really exploring the difficult parts of life and where that's going to take us and what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really careful to stay away from anything that would be like moralizing,
mm-hmm.
because I think that that's extremely destructive to your ability to succeed as an author. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I hate it as a reader. But at the same time, I think that the most powerful stories are always the ones that have very strong thematic messages of truth, whatever mm-hmm. that may be, whether it's something, you know, tremendous and global or just something really small and intimate.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm struck with a story idea, it's usually in a very, almost on an emotional level, I guess. There's just something that is appealing to me in a situation and in some person that's struggling in some way with something. And mm-hmm. I usually don't even know what it is in the beginning. It just kind of develops like an onion, layers of an onion mm-hmm. peeling off. But eventually as we start going and I start getting a sense of the conflict and where it's going to go, I can kind of understand how this character is going to develop over the course of the story, how he's going to change and grow out of whatever lies he believes in the beginning and finally grow into some kind of a truth, because
right.
I generally do deal with positive change arcs. Then eventually, you know, the theme is going to be buried in the middle there, and that's always exciting to kind of finally identify that and get to start fleshing that out.
Right. So, you know, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is, of course, focused on giving authors a chance to explore a little bit more deeply and share with my listeners how they're hoping to positively impact the world sort of one reader at a time. You know, like what do they envision may occur after someone has read their poetry or their book or novel, whatever, you know, and what was that backdoor intention that they may have had, not even in the beginning, but eventually realize, like you said, at the bottom of the onion, be like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at. And then they go back, revision number 27, you know, and they're like, and they sort of realize they can flesh it out a little bit mm-hmm. or, you know, or give it more body and more power, more depth. I go to bookstores because you can see them all right in front of you. They're all displayed. Mm-hmm. And I have a notebook and I write down the ones I'm interested in. And then I go to the library. And I check out, you know, 25 books or something. And then I go home and I start to scroll through and toss the ones to the side that don't grab me and I'm not interested in. There were these books that could have been really incredibly awesome, just fun stories mm-hmm. with moral value expressed and discovered. But the authors threw in these big, long monologues of lecturing.
Yeah.
And it was really clear what they were doing. So I was hoping that you might, for the people out there who say, I really want to get this message across and this story is the way to do it. So how are people going to be able to write a novel that carries that message forward that they want, you know, eco-fiction type of thing, you know, vegan, whatever that goal is that you want to get out there? How can they do that effectively and not destroy the story in the process?
Well, one thing, somebody read this a long time ago, and I can't remember who, so I can't give him credit, but he had said that the purpose of a novel is not to offer answers, it's to ask questions. And I just found that so profound, because I think when we're trying to tell people this is the way, you know, eat vegan, it's the only way, they just shut us out. They're like, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. that's your opinion, I don't appreciate you trying to ram it down my throat.
Mm-hmm.
And they just shut you out. Even if your message is right, even if it's really good, they don't want to hear it because of the way it's delivered so dogmatically. And particularly when they're doing something for entertainment, they do not appreciate having
right.
someone turn it into a sermon. It's
right.
like, you know, how my mother used to sneak the greens into my smoothie, and I always knew, and it just doesn't work.
Mom, the spinach got stuck in my teeth. No,
yeah. Anyway, but I think when we're asking questions, it becomes more of a shared thing. Like we're all sharing, mm-hmm. you know, is this true? You know, is this what we should be doing? It's not an invasive thing. It's mm-hmm. a shared exploration of life.
Right.
So that's something that I always try to keep in mind when I'm writing. And I think it's important at some point in the story to adamantly state whatever your moral premise is, probably
mm-hmm.
very late in the story. But for the most part, keep your options open and don't be afraid to try to sell the opposite side of whatever you're saying just as strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people can see both sides, that's where the questions really arise. And it also, it comes across as so much more honest as
right.
well. And it's obvious that you're not just trying to sell them something, basically.
Right.
So I think that one of the reasons that a lot of authors are kind of scared of theme, you know, in the sense that they're going to end up moralizing to their readers, Because that's something that we hear a lot, is that authors, I don't want to think too much about my theme. I don't want to look at it, you know, because it'll become too concrete. And I see where they're coming with that, but I ultimately disagree with it, because I feel that if we can claim it, that we can do a much better job of presenting it.
Right. It's like you don't want to deny, you know, your own truth or something like that. And awareness doesn't mean that suddenly now you're forced to fail or do it wrong. It's like you want to, I mean, you know, if you are looking to publish a book and you want hundreds, thousands of people or more to read it, then you really have to take full ownership of it.
Right.
And be the mature professional who says, you know, I'm not hiding from myself, of all things, in the middle of doing this.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah. And the thing is, I think once you, this is something that was really just kind of mind-blowing for me in discovering kind of the structure of character arcs, that that is where a theme comes into play. If you set your character arc up right, you don't have to think about the theme, because it's there. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you intend it to or not, that's what's happening when you are creating a character arc. This evolution from a lie that the character believes in the beginning to a truth that you are proclaiming, whether you realize it consciously or not, at the end, which the character is going to embrace. One thing I do think that's important to understand, though, is that there's a really big difference between a story's theme and a story's message. The theme is going to be like a general principle, like love is good and that kind of thing. Where a message is going to be a specific example of that theme in action. It's going to be something that's super specific to how your story plays out. So let's say that, like, the theme is vengeance is a destructive act.
Right.
Well, that's a generally accepted principle. That's a theme that everybody can pretty much get on board with.
Right.
But how you play that out in the story and basically prove it to readers, that's going to be your message. So
I would imagine you'd probably need someone as a character who is actually an advocate for vengeance.
Yeah.
And then has a change through their experiences and causes them to realize that it's not great.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's the whole show don't tell thing, which most authors are familiar with.
Right.
You cannot tell readers your theme. You have to show it to them. And that's, you know, something that's going to play out in how your characters are themselves grappling with these issues, and how hopefully it's not black and white. It doesn't come easily to them, because that's where all those interesting questions are going to be raised that hopefully readers are going to also be engaged by.
Right. And, you know, I think probably for any person out there who wants to improve the world one reader at a time, that happens better when you've got more people in the world that are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you can, you know, suggest thoughts and ideas and whatnot. But ultimately, if you're asking, if they're asking questions, they're engaging the brain that they were born with, and they're engaging their thoughts, and they're actively involved in being a thinking person. And this world benefits from more from open-mindedness than it does from people who just shut their brains and stop. So.
Yeah, and I think that ultimately, you know, just even if they don't walk away believing what you believe, just the very act that you've gotten them thinking about whatever it is is a positive thing.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, yeah, questions lead to more questions so often. It's like an ever-expanding journey.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that truth speaks for itself. It doesn't need me to defend it. It doesn't need me to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is earnestly, you know, has that heart that is seeking truth, then they're going to find it, you know, with or without my help. But if I can, if my story can in any way be just a tiny little clue along the path, then that's something that I'm totally happy with, you know, and probably it's happening in ways that I never intended, you know. It's not actually the truth of my theme. It's some nugget here or there. You know, if that's happening, that's completely awesome. And I sincerely hope that it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so let's see here. Your website, again, is www.kmweiland.com. So that's W-E-I-L-A-N-D.com. And you've just got, I mean, for the person who wants to write a book, whether it's your first novel or whether you've been working on them for a while, there's everything from outlining your novel, structuring your novels. There's a few things like that, writer's block, and summoning inspiration. Haha, that's a good Christmas present. And then for people who just want to recreationally enjoy themselves, tell me a little bit real quick here. Why does it look like Jane Eyre Writers? What is that on your website? Is that something you created?
Okay, real quick here, I'll just throw out that KM Wyland is actually more my personal writing site where I just kind of talk about my books and my own writing process.
Sure.
And if you want like the writing help and instruction, that's actually at helpingwritersbecomeauthors.com.
Got it. Helpingwritersbecomeauthors.com. And this, I think this is already in your bio. So when people go to the website, my website, they're going to have this information in the bio. If it isn't, I'll go ahead and try and make sure it gets in there.
Yeah, it should be.
Okay, awesome.
So anyway, about Jane Eyre. Yeah, that was kind of an exciting project. That was something that Writer's Digest was doing. They were wanting to put together this series of classic novels that had been annotated specifically with writers in mind. Basically, you know, what did these authors do and do so well that we're still reading their books hundreds of years later, and what
right.
did we learn from them?
Yeah.
So they approached me about doing that, which I was really excited about, because reading the classics is something that I'm really committed to. And
annotated means you've gone through and given comments.
Right. So what it is basically is it's the full novel of Jane Eyre, mm-hmm. and then I have gone through and commented on, you know, various aspects of the technique and the story. And the thing for me was that I really wasn't expecting was, I mean, honestly, writing that book, it was one of the hardest books I've ever written,
mm-hmm.
but it completely transformed the way I thought about story and really was the foundation for
mm-hmm.
where I got a lot of my ideas and understanding of character arcs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really transformational for me to write it, and
right.
I got a lot out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a few books that I particularly really, really like, and have worked really well in the world, and the, you know, sort of this, right? The books mm-hmm. that millions of people have read, and I often would just flip it open and start reading through, analyzing it in a way, you know, and just like, well, when do I feel this way? So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, why are we still reading Jane Austen? Why are we still reading, you know, Charlotte Bronte? You know, what's going on that hundreds of years worth of people have been so fascinated by these stories? That's okay. That's great. So that explains what that is, just because I wouldn't have known. I would have been like, I don't understand.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's a fabulous idea, but I was a little surprised that they did it, just because I feel like it's one of those products you have to educate consumers about, or it's not clear what it is. But
Right. But now I'm like, oh, okay. So this is great. Now I've learned something once again. I learned something. I mean, I have the best radio show. I love it. Okay. So is there one last thing you want to throw out there? Because we're basically out of time.
Well, I guess just basically that I've had a really great time chatting with you, and I hope that everyone enjoys it as well, and that they stop by and visit me. Say hi.
Yeah, absolutely. I thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to call in and chat with me. And I'm really appreciating Stormy. I'm looking forward to reading it, like I said, over the holidays. So everyone, it's a diesel punk adventure novel titled Storming, and it's KM Wyland. And I think all the other information's pretty much been put out there. So basically, that's our show, folks. My name is March Twisdale. You've been listening to my interview with Katie Wyland. Thank you for tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world and lots of other things, one reader and one listener at a time. And now I'll leave you with the inspirational song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw At liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We had little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the street. We occupy the courts. We occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.